From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's estimated that one in 68 children in the United States is now identified with an autism spectrum disorder. While they're young, through age 21, federal law guarantees them an education support. But once they reach full adulthood, that all changes. The autism doesn't go away. The support does. It can be an overwhelming moment for these young adults and their families. 50,000 young adults a year are facing the cutoff and a huge challenge. This hour on Point, aging out of America's autism support network. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this you, your child? What are you facing? How will you manage? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in a moment from Kate Snow with NBC News. They've done some tremendous reporting lately on exactly this problem, dilemma, this moment in lives that can be so jarring. Joining me first today from Philadelphia is Paul Shattuck, author of the National Autism Indicators Report, Transition into Young Adulthood, coming out next week. Paul is associate professor at the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute and leader of the Institute's research program on life course outcomes. Paul Shattuck, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for giving attention to this important but very overlooked issue.
We are happy to do it. We've talked a lot about autism over time here. It's such an interesting and difficult terrain for families who are in the midst of it. And you and others are now looking at one of the most difficult moments. Give us a sense, first of all, of just the size of this population. I think this 1 in 68 comes from you. Is that newborns? Is that a number that's climbing? Is it getting? Is that ratio getting higher year by year? What's the prevalence of young Americans on the autism spectrum disorder now, Paul?
Sure. Here's the big picture, Tom. The 1 in 68 number comes from the Federal Centers for Disease Control. They do an ongoing study about the prevalence of autism and other developmental disorders in 8-year-old children. So that's the most recent estimate we have of how common autism is in 8-year-old children. But our best estimate is that somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000 youth on the autism spectrum are turning 18 years old each year. This adds up to roughly 500,000 in the next decade.
50,000 turning 18 each year. Now, they call it a spectrum for a reason because, you know, they'll have some very, very high-functioning people on this spectrum and others who have a lot of difficulty functioning in society independently at all. How does that break down, Paul?
Tom, that's a great question. We actually have relatively little knowledge of the exact breakdown of what percentage of people leaving high school will need a very high level of support versus which percentage of people will most likely go on to independent lives. Most high school students with autism do receive special education services, and those services can include things like job training, social skill development, language and communication skill development, and mental health counseling. But the amount of help students receive in terms of these services varies depending on the level of need in the student as well as the level of resources available in school, which, as you know, schools vary in terms of how affluent the district is and what level of support they can give students in general, much less students with autism.
So there's no one standard for what they have in terms of services when they're younger. But when they hit that number, 21, which is when federal law, I guess, says you're no longer covered by public schooling, do some support stick around, or does everything they may have had go away?
Pretty much the latter. So federal law requires that schools help these students create what's called a transition plan, and this is supposed to line up either further education like college or some kind of employment for the period immediately following high school. This help goes away when young people finish high school, and families often call this the services cliff.
Or the aging out moment.
Yes.
I'm still scratching my head about the, it's hard to believe it's a complete mystery, what percentage of people on this autism spectrum could go on to higher education, what percentage might be employable, and what percentage would need constant care.
Right. Well, we know for sure that roughly one in three of these young people will go on to some sort of post-secondary education like college. We know that over during the through the early 20s, roughly half of young adults will find some sort of paid work. Maybe one-third will continue their education, and some do both. But one-third of all young adults with autism will do none of the above. They're completely disconnected from opportunities to participate in and contribute to their communities. And this rate of complete disconnection from opportunity is over 50% in the first year or two after high school.
Do they complete this transition plan? And what does it mean if they're not able to connect socially?
No, that's a great question. Most eventually complete a transition plan. The quality and execution of those transition plans, as you might imagine, varies enormously across school districts. We do have some data on what we call functional skills. So approximately 50% of these young people are unable or have great difficulty with common tasks like counting change, telling time on a clock, or using a phone. Most have some degree of ability to communicate, sometimes using a special device or an iPad. But only about half are able to converse with little or no trouble, and roughly 15 to 20% are unable to converse at all. So again, this ability level and the impairment level varies widely, which is why you have some people, you know, lives turning out better and some people not so much. But then also the amount of support available in a given community varies enormously from community to community and state to state.
I want to keep that wide variation fully in mind. You'll have people on the spectrum who may go on to get PhDs, and this 50,000 annually. Does that how wide is the spectrum now? Does that include people with what we call Asperger's?
That's correct. Yeah, the recent sort of reformulation of what counts as autism spectrum disorder includes a range of abilities ranging from extremely impaired to extremely capable.
How do families? If they're in the 50% that can't, their child, let's say, is in the 50% that can't do common tasks, or in the portion that can't connect, can't even necessarily communicate verbally, what do they tend to do? What's the range of things that do? Somebody quits work or never did work because they were raising this child, just stays home. And, of course, parents are much older than their children. How do they look at the future?
Well, one of the most important things we found in our research on this transitional period is that in every level of ability, even among those who are most severely impaired, there are some people who are finding employment, finding connection with opportunities in their community to make a contribution, to participate. So it's, you know, that this failure to connect to opportunity is not entirely a function of a person's ability level.
Mm-hmm.
It's very largely driven by the level of opportunities that are available in a community. And in that sense, really, I think we have this incredibly untapped potential in this population. And I think, you know, here at the Drexel Autism Institute, we basically have a belief that people on the spectrum are valuable members of our communities who have roles to play and contributions to make. And really, our job as researchers and as neighbors is to help identify those opportunities that can unlock those potentials.
I mean, we have talked with people on this show who specifically hire employees on the spectrum because of the
exactly.
kind of focus that they can bring to particular tasks and job arenas that are maybe particularly valuable. We know, for anybody, it can be very satisfying. It is satisfying for people on the spectrum, autism spectrum, to be out and working in the world. I've got a little sound here, Paul, of Andrew Lyne. He's 20 years old, autism, had got independent when he turned 20, got a job working at a local library, and this week he told news station KSL in Salt Lake City that working, getting out of the house, helped him feel more like an adult.
I do feel like being outside that environment has helped me to like find more of myself.
Andrew Lyon, on the spectrum, out and working, and very happy for it. But that is not always possible. NBC has done this tremendous reporting in the last few days. And here's just a bit from that. This was talking with a guest soon to join us, Kate Snow, on NBC's Dateline. Their report, On the Brink, it aired on Sunday. Here's Lenora Cabisco saying she worries about what life will be like for her son, who's definitely on the spectrum, without the kind of support that they've had in the past.
To raise an autistic child, you can't do it without the help. And right now, I don't know how we're going to do it. I don't know what kind of life he's going to have because we're looking at a really barren landscape for him. I don't think I've ever been more terrified than I am right now.
Paul Shattuck, you hear the emotion teetering into despair right there. We have more and more kids on the spectrum. There have always been people with intellectual challenges. My brother was Down syndrome. I remember very well the family trying to plan for how that would all unfold. Is autism different, Paul, in what it requires in terms of long-time, full-life care, oversight, support?
Gosh, Tom, what a great question. What a moving, commentary from those families on the Dateline special. You have to realize that people on the autism spectrum are varied, have very different needs. And what's especially different in the world of autism versus, say, Down syndrome is that it's only recently that the research community and clinical community has been paying more attention to this whole life course story about how life unfolds across the lifespan. You know, autism was sort of discovered, if you will, by a child psychiatrist in the 1940s and traditionally has often been considered a childhood condition. In fact, at one point it was called childhood schizophrenia way back in the day. So there's kind of this inertia of clinical disciplines that have tended to do research on autism are not those disciplines that often think in terms of lifespan development. So it's really, if you look at the history of knowledge creation and research on autism, very little research has historically been done on adolescence and adulthood.
Paul, we've just got 20 seconds. What's the bottom line of your report? Federal government come in and take care of this, or all hands on deck?
All hands on deck. I think we need community-supported efforts from the voluntary nonprofit sector, from churches, from governments, and from businesses. I think we've had a tremendous demonstration of support from the business community that has really changed the game and challenged existing paradigms about how we can provide support as a nation for a vulnerable population.
Paul Shattuck with the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute at Drexel University in Philadelphia. Their National Autism Indicators Report comes out next week. Transition into Young Adulthood is its focus. Paul, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about young Americans with autism aging out of the education system. And then what? For them, for their families, big question marks here, big difficulties, and not a lot of support. Often, none. NBC has done some terrific reporting on this lately. In On the Brink, a Dateline report that aired on Sunday, here's a little bit where Lenore Cabisco, the mother of 21-year-old Nick, who's on the spectrum, describes her first days after Nick left the education system, his graduation.
I remember pulling the shades, turning on the air conditioner, and saying, okay, buddy, it's just me and you.
As the weeks go on, Lenore is watching her son regress before her eyes.
His personality dimmed. His willingness to interact dimmed because there's less practice. There's less to do. There's less opportunity. It's like it's literally dimming the lights.
Kate Snow there talking with Lenore Cabisco about her circumstance, and she has looked much more widely. Kate Snow of NBC national correspondent joins us right now from Oklahoma City. Her Dateline report chronicled the lives of two young adults with autism transitioning into adulthood, aired on Sunday. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can link to a big list of resources that NBC has put together there, too, on autism and transitioning into adulthood at the same website, onpointradio.org. Kate Snow joins us from Oklahoma. Kate, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
This was a tremendous report. It really got our attention. We've paid a lot of attention to spectrum disorder, autism over the years. What got you focused on this, Kate?
Thank you so much. Honestly, oh boy, I have a wonderful producer who I worked with on this project named Marjorie McAfee, and she 3 years ago pitched this idea, said to our top producers, we should be looking not just at kids with autism, but at what happens when they reach that critical point and age out. Not a lot of reporting had been done on that age group. And so it was really her idea, in part because her cousin has two children who were facing that very same hurdle. She started following two families, including Lenore Cabisco, who you just heard from. 3 years ago, Tom. And then a year ago, as happens in our business, she brought me into the project. So she'd already been following the families with camera, with her little camera, for a couple of years, and brought me in a year ago. And I, too, have autism in my family. And so this is something that I've reported a lot on, and it was deeply personal for me, too.
We heard from Paul Shattuck at Drexel about, of course, we all know the range of severity of disorder.
Yes.
It can be really debilitating, or people can be extremely high-functioning and very valuable employees and all the rest. What about the two young men, in this case, Nick and Eric, the sons of these two families? Where are they on the spectrum, Kate?
Yeah, and as you might imagine, we cast a wide net looking for families. We ended up with these amazing families who I can't thank enough. Can you imagine having a camera follow you in and out for 3 years?
Through this Nick, kind of difficult passage, too.
It is, exactly. Nick Kabisko, who you just heard his mother, Lenore, is a young man who lives on Long Island. If there's a spectrum, he's further down the spectrum. He has difficulty communicating. In fact, he doesn't verbally communicate. He uses a device on an iPad-type computer to speak for him, called a Dynavox.
Mm-hmm.
That's Nick's story. He needs a lot of support. He's had some trouble in his late teens, mid to late teens. They tried at one point to put him into a residential program.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That didn't really work out very well for them. They brought him home. Right at the point of the story where he was about to turn 21 and graduate, he had at home tutors and aides helping him. And that's why you heard Lenore with such desperation, so worried, because she knew those aides and tutors that were being paid for by her local public school district were about to simply go away. They weren't going to be paid for anymore. That's their story. And then Eric Sadowski is the other young man who we followed. Now, he is verbal. He does talk, and he's a fascinating guy to get to know. As you said before, so everyone who's on this spectrum, I think they have gifts and talents. He's an artist. His mother, Mary Clancy, is also an artist and an incredible advocate for him. He was going to a school that was paid for, School for People with Developmental Disabilities, paid for by his local public school district after a long legal battle by his parents, by the way. And he was about to graduate from that school with no plan.
We have a little sound here of his mother, Mary. This is from NBC's On the Brink report. And Eric is headed out of high school, 21 years old at this point. He's skipping in the gym at school with his classmates. And here's his mom worrying about having him leave.
Without purposeful things to do, he will fall back into the autism world, into his own inner world. He's so much happier out of it, but that's where his brain takes him. It's hard. I really need these people, and I can't have them anymore.
And here's Lenore talking about her son, Nick, and what she's most afraid of when Nick goes out of that environment of support.
Pulling that plug. His world is going to collapse. Everything that we've spent, the hours, the dollars, is about to go down the drain.
Kate Snow with NBC brought us the report. Kate, when Mary Clancy talks about her son Eric falling back into that autism world, what does she mean?
She means regressing. She means actually losing language skills, which I hate to tell you is what we saw over the months after he graduated from the Rebecca School. We continued to follow them. And those first, I'd say, 6 months, you see it in the Dateline hour. At one point, he forgets the word circle. He just can't come up with the word. So, he was isolated. He was at home with his mom much of the time. Now,
yeah.
To their credit, they tried to do things for him. And it's not like they weren't looking for programs and places for Eric to go. They absolutely were. And they did get him into an art class that they paid for, a music class that they paid for. He was part of a running club. So he was getting out of the house a few times a week, but for the most part, he was sitting at home, his mom said, staring at the walls.
And there's the cost of all this.
Yes.
Here's Mary Clancy again, mother of 21-year-old Eric, telling NBC and Kate Snow about the costs of trying to find support once the kids age out or hit this point in adulthood.
Probably our least expensive year has been about $40,000, and the higher ones have been around $90,000.
$90,000
mm-hmm.
for a year.
Yeah, we haven't been able to save any money. We don't have retirement. But it's kind of like when people ask me, how much does it cost to raise a kid with autism? Everything you've got.
Kate Snow, wait a minute. I think I got that wrong. They're spending that kind of money even when he was under 21.
Yeah, it varied from year to year.
Yeah.
But it has been a financial drain on their family, on both of these families, for years now. And which is why she was so concerned about having at least some support paid for by the government programs. Now, you know, we did have some response of people saying, shouldn't it be the family's responsibility? Why should the government have to pay for all of this? And that's a political question. You know, mm-hmm. that's a question of what states want to do to support young people with disabilities. Most of the help that they end up getting after age 21 comes through Medicaid. And as you know, Medicaid is a federal program but administered by the states. And that's also why you see wide variations in terms of what's available from state to state.
So let's say that a young adult here can't work, or they could work but they can't live independently. What are the options that are out there, Kate?
It's a patchwork, Tom. I think what was so heartbreaking is that, you know, even when you have a set of parents like these two families who want to do the very best and are big advocates for their sons, they can't figure out where the programs exist, who to call. Mary describes, both of them describe, making phone call after phone call after phone call. At one point, Lenore had Nick put on a waiting list. He was getting rejected by social workers. They couldn't find a social worker to handle his case. It's just bureaucracy and red tape and sort of, I guess, a battle to find the right fit and the right program. It's not that there aren't programs available. There are. But they're varied, and you're sort of left as a parent to figure it all out yourself. That was one of the biggest complaints.
Here's a little bit from your NBC report where Lenore Cabisco is there in Florida. Her husband has been relocated there for work, and they're trying to find services for their son, Nick. You can hear her talking with the woman on the other end of the phone.
How immediately do you need those services? We have quite a long waiting list.
Can you give me a hint?
Like 22,000 people on the waiting list.
Okay, that's a big reality check.
Oh, wait, I guess they're face-to-face, but 22,000 people on the waiting list.
And that woman goes on to say, we were in there with a microphone, and that woman goes on to say, we have great weather in Florida, but I always tell people don't move here.
Because their state supports are, what, not great for this category?
Because there's a 22,000-person waiting list. Now, we obviously called the state of Florida for comment. They say they're working very hard at reducing that waiting list, and they've made some progress in the last couple of years, was their response to us. But, yeah, the husband had to move and has now moved to Florida for his job. And what ended up happening is Lenore and Nick and his sister stayed in New York. They split the family because the services they had in New York, at that point in the story, they had actually found a way to get some services in New York. They were going to lose those services if they moved to Florida with Nick, so they decided to split the family in half.
I mean, Kate, a lot of people will be sympathetic to the view that, look, you know, the government stepped in here when they were younger, did a lot, can't support people for their whole lives. But when you talked with Lenore, as she looked out on the rest of her son's life and her own and her daughter's, it was just heartbreaking. I mean, she essentially, her life is entirely given over to this. Okay. But she's thinking, no, her daughter is going to have to become the caretaker, perhaps for the rest of her life, for her brother as well.
Yeah. And you know what one of Lenore's biggest points was? She kept saying, we're not looking for handouts. We're looking for ways for Nick to be a contributing member of society. I mean, if we have one in 68 young people, being 8-year-olds, being diagnosed with autism on the spectrum, that's a huge number of people in our community who could be contributing and giving back and be productive members of the community. That's what these families want. They don't want them to sit at home. So, you know, she kept saying, we're not asking for freebies. We're not asking for welfare. We're asking for a way for him to contribute.
Kate Snow, stand by in Oklahoma City. Lisa's calling from Nashville. Lisa, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a 21-year-old daughter here in Nashville, Tennessee, and she ages out in one more year. She has moderately severe autism, severe speech-language impairment, and intellectual disabilities. So this is the first time I've broken up about this.
It's okay. So it's okay, Lisa. It's okay. What's your plan, or do you have one yet?
My plan is to relocate and to leave the state of Tennessee. My daughter has been on the waiting list for about 10 years with no movement. We're next to the highest category because I'm a single mother, and I'm looking to relocate herself and myself in a year when she ages out of her services, because we are bottom 10 nationally for what we provide. Unlike Florida, which has 22,000 people, or Ohio, yep, 40,000 people on their list, we have 7,000 because our parameters are so small. We have changed the name of the department to Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, but right now you have to only have an intellectual disability. She meets the criteria that way. Our legislature has refused, and we have been to the legislature. We have sophisticated advocates year after year,
yeah,
go down and try to get compassion from these people. And they look to possibly be modifying it to allow parents, to sons and daughters, to get off the list when their parents turn 80. And, Tom, I'm not going to sit around for 25 more years in Tennessee for the legislators who also failed to expand Medicaid for uninsured Tennesseans to wake up and help this graying silver tsunami of baby boomers approaching 65 years for me.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter is also an artist, nationally acclaimed, gracegoad.com, mm-hmm, and on Facebook. And my family is fortunate. Her father's very involved, that we'll be able to provide housing for her. But how can a family that's not making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 and up provide that 24/7 care that she needs? So it's abysmal anywhere pretty much in the South, and I know it's not perfect anywhere, but we need some support to help her succeed, to give the caregivers, the aging caregivers, a break. Who will no longer be there. And I am unlike some of these people. We're all in the same boat. I'm not saying worse or better, mm-hmm, or comparing, but there are no siblings in our family. You know, where are the safety nets? There's no safety nets. We got to wake up and have compassion for these people that so desperately have a potential, but no safety nets.
Lisa, I'm grateful for your call, and I wish you good luck. You say you're planning to move, to leave. Where are you planning to go?
Right now, trying to limit it to the South so I can be in proximity of family, 2 hours from her paternal grandmother, and her father, and then an hour drive, day's drive of my sisters in the Carolinas. And so it's not looking good anywhere in the South in order to maintain that community of familial support for herself, myself, and everyone involved. I don't want to lose that piece, but I'm trying to look at, the lesser of evils. North Carolina has wonderful services, but they've got 10,000 people on their waiting list. So I'm getting a rude punch in the gut wake-up call all around me. Ideally I'd move out west, but do I lose my supports for family? Her father's very involved in her life.
Yeah. Lisa, all we can do right here is wish you good luck, point you to the resources. You can link to it at our website. It sounds like you're pretty good on the studying the resources already, but we do wish you good luck, and we thank you for your call. Kate Snow, you must have heard plenty of stories like this one.
Yeah, we have. The outpouring after airing our hour on Sunday, Tom, has been unlike anything I've seen for a Dateline hour before, quite frankly. More people have responded online, on social media, through our viewer email inbox. Most is very much like what Lisa just said. It's parents reaching out and saying, this is me, this is my story, I don't know what to do either. On the other hand, we also did get a lot of people writing in about programs that are working, about places, small pockets of a movie theater in Connecticut where they're hiring all people with autism, or a place where a facility where people are working, on a farm. I mean, there are programs out there, and a lot of those folks reached out to us as well.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about young Americans with autism aging out of the country's education system. And then what? For them, for their families, a lot of big question marks out there, big difficulties, and not a lot of support. Often, none or next to none. Kate Snow is with us, national correspondent for NBC News. She and her producers have done a lot of work on this, came out with a terrific report on Dateline on Sunday called On the Brink. Following a couple of families really wrestling with this, with kids, not kids anymore, headed into their 20s with serious impairment. Of course, the spectrum is wide, and many can go on and do great things and have a lot of independence. Many cannot. Kate Snow, please stand by. Joining us right now from Phoenix, Arizona, is Denise Resnick. She's a mother of 23-year-old with autism, founder of First Place, a transition academy for young adults, co-founder of the Southwest Autism Research and Resource Center. Denise Resnick, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom, for focusing on this heartbreaking and powerful issue.
What has been your personal experience with your son, Matthew?
Well, I've been dreaming about this time almost from the first day the school bus arrived. And 2 years ago when he graduated, it was a sobering time, trying to figure out how we were going to fill 168 hours every week of some kind of meaningful, productive activity. We teamed up with the Southwest Autism Research and Resource Center through their Rising Entrepreneurs program, and we helped Matt create a home bakery business. And it's called Smile Biscotti, which is an acronym that stands for Supporting Matt's Independent Living Enterprise.
All right. So he's baking biscotti in your kitchen, or...?
He is baking biscotti in our kitchen. We have actually graduated and are borrowing a commercial kitchen a few days a week. And he has increased his work capacity from 60 minutes to 6 hours. He has now 6 co-workers with autism and special needs. And those young people have sold more than 89,000 biscotti.
That's pretty awesome. How do you describe, Denise, where Matthew is on the spectrum? I don't know how people in this realm speak to one another about it, but how do you describe it?
Matt is classic autism. He has a very difficult time communicating. He always wants to be right, so he'll say yes to just about everything. Mm-hmm. He does he's challenged with some of his processing issues, but he's a very hardworking kid, and he will tick off everything on his iPad. I believe he actually enjoys checking the things off sometimes more than he enjoys doing them. But he is he's productive. He is contributing to this community. He's an employer. He contributes to the food bank every week, the broken pieces of biscotti.
So he can bake. Can he manage the other workers in the bakery as well?
No, he doesn't manage them. Each of them come with their special abilities, and there are some that actually oversee some of his work. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to cracking eggs or measuring sugar or vanilla or zesting oranges, Matt is he loves all the measuring and mixing and packaging of the biscotti. And we've also been able to integrate other skills as it relates to cleaning and laundering and shopping, banking. So it's not just about baking biscotti, but it's also a demonstration of indicating that individuals with autism have abilities and do belong as contributing members of our community.
We totally get that. I mean, Kate Snow in her report makes that very clear as well. I guess my question for you, Denise, is what kind of support from outside is been necessary to get this up and running, to keep it up and running? The question here, I guess, is what sort of supports are required to facilitate? This is a wonderful story, but it hasn't happened in a vacuum. Are you full-time backing up Matt and the enterprise, or is somebody else?
We do have family, and we do have volunteers that have been working with him and others mm-hmm. as part of this broader Rising Entrepreneurs program through SARC. And beyond this specific program, it's been about looking more broadly at the community, not just to specific autism programs, but what happens at the local YMCA through the libraries, opportunities to volunteer and opportunities to build skills. And that's something that Stark did many years ago in creating a community-based program where our young adults have been volunteering with neurotypical peers for years in dozens of nonprofits, building their skills, building their resume, and helping, again, understand that individuals with autism can contribute to community. And I tell you, the number one concern for families like ours when our son is so vulnerable mm-hmm. because of his autism is safety and security. Mm-hmm. And I learned early on that it's not the technology. It's more eyes and ears that keep these kids safe, making them part of our communities.
Kate Snow, how do you take this story on board? I mean, it sounds great. Matthew's pumping out the biscotti, and it's going great.
I'd like to buy some of the biscotti.
Yeah, me too. Smile wonderful. Biscotti. I'm in. But, you know, Denise is describing a community that's ready and willing to engage yes. and help facilitate this. Would this be an option for the young men that you followed, Kate?
If it existed where they live, I think absolutely. And I think that's the point, is there are a lot of individualized programs going, you know, like what Denise is doing, going on in various cities. We've heard about a lot of them. It's just sometimes hard to, you know, you're not geographically near them, or they cost maybe some money. In some cases, the parents end up having to front some of the money for these things. It's varied. But I'm so happy to hear from Denise. I know we had talked with her a couple of years ago when we were starting our project mm-hmm. and heard a lot about what she's doing. She's known in the community for doing absolutely great, great things. And just to mention, I don't want to leave anyone on a down note about Eric and Nick, who mm-hmm. we followed. Mm-hmm. Eric is an artist, and in the later months after he graduated, he was able to get into a program called Pure Vision Arts in New York City, where he's now there 5 days a week, and that's a charity-funded nonprofit organization, so it's not costing his family money. And actually, after our program aired on Sunday, people have been reaching out and wanting to buy his artworks and the artwork of all the people at Pure Vision Arts. So that's a sort of a happy ending for his family. They feel like they're in a much better place than they were a year ago.
We're happy to hear that. Of course, not everybody gets the spotlight of an NBC News report, but we're happy for that outcome. Maciel, calling from New Orleans. Maciel, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What's your story?
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yes.
Well, I was calling just to perhaps to talk about prevention.
Prevention,
I mean,
okay.
My experience living here has been very difficult. I have a son that has autism, and he's 15 years old now.
Okay.
And the past 3 years, I have been homeschooling him. And previous that, he was going to the school, and basically the teachers or people would say that he couldn't learn, that he didn't even know his name. I would send him with his iPad, and they wouldn't use it in the day. He would cry and just get depressed and all those things. And finally, yeah. I had to challenge legally to the school system, and nothing, to no avail. I had to remove my son from the school, because the school system, instead of trying to help my son, because I was asking them to do applied behavior analysis, a
yes.
method that worked for my son, because we were doing at home for years when he was younger, privately hiring people from Atlanta, from other places,
yeah.
spending lots of money.
Yeah.
And we were asking just to do 2 hours a day so he could continue learning. But he will go there and just do nothing. They will say that he doesn't learn.
Maciel, is your son verbal? How does he communicate?
He's nonverbal, mm-hmm. but now he communicates with his iPad.
What do you expect when he turns 20 or 21?
I don't know. I'm just trying to work with him. I'm trying to get, finally, we are lucky that the government is paying through Medicaid for this kind of therapy. And my son now is going to a private school for a half a day, and for a half a day he's getting this therapy. And I can see that he's improving more than he did before, and I can see that he can even show that he can read some words, he can type his name, he knows his name, he can communicate. The thing is that he didn't get enough integration at the time that when he needed the most.
Yeah, Maciel, we wish you good luck, and we hear how difficult this can be. Denise Resnick, what kind of support's required here? I mean, through 21, federal law requires a certain kind of state engagement here. It varies by state, but nevertheless, do we need, given the numbers here and often the severity of this, do we need government to step in for life or something else, Denise?
We need all hands on deck. We need the public sector and government. Certainly we need the private sector and looking at paths forward through business and how we can engage more individuals with autism. And we need the charitable sector also to invest in these enterprising opportunities that may not attract traditional financing. We all have to work together. There's no silver bullet here. What we've opted to do in Arizona, mm-hmm. primarily in Greater Phoenix, is looking to more private sector solutions and where we can collaborate with government, but really leading with good market principles.
Market principles with that entrepreneurial bug attached. And if you've got it, good on you. It may work. Not everybody does, I guess. Jane in Hartford, Connecticut. Jane, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah. What's your story?
Well, I'd like to first thank everybody who's been on so far and know what everyone has been through. I live personally and professionally with this topic. My son is 23 years old, and we fell off the cliff that everyone's talking about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. The difference that I see is everyone is always so happy at college graduations. It's a huge milestone for your kids. And we had two daughters who graduated before my son, and high school graduation is huge, and so is college.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a very different feeling with my son, because you knew everything was about to end. We had a lot of trouble with what we were doing for transition, and we very fortunately got him into a wonderful program. But part of that, because we needed residential, my husband and I bought a house right near the program.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you actually moved near where he would be?
No, we bought a house, and they found two other young people to live there as a group home.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we took what we had saved as my son's college fund and what we had sent our daughters with to college. We used that money to buy a house and have staff from the day program. Unfortunately, a year ago, my husband was diagnosed with cancer. And so for the past year, everything that we've put into the house and to caring for our son and all the work that we do together to help raise him, it's been increasingly difficult. And I think many families who deal with chronic illness have that issue also, because then you're dealing with trying to care for someone who needs care 24/7 and then a chronic illness in addition.
How deeply do you think government should be involved in this, Jane?
Well, and that's where my professional perspective comes in mm-hmm. a little bit, because it does get complicated. For 16 years, I've run a group called College Autism Spectrum. I work with college students with autism. I've been in disability services for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I work at UConn Law School as their disability coordinator, and I work at Yale Child Study with mm-hmm. adults on the spectrum on college issues. And at Yale Child Study right now, we have a program for women, many of whom have graduated from college, and the employment that many people are talking about, because so many of our women really struggle with employment, as the men do too,
mm-hmm.
but women especially, because they often get diagnosed later. But there are about 20 colleges. We have a website that we try and keep as a resource for families and for other schools to help them start programs for students on the spectrum and run those specialized services that so many of our college students need above and beyond the basic disability services, because so many of our students are college capable, and we know from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that bachelor's degree and beyond really helps employment long term.
Jane, I appreciate your call. I want to try and get one more here while we have time. Laura in Arlington, Massachusetts. Laura, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you so much to everyone for doing this. I've been in the field. I'm a neuropsychologist, and for 30 years, these are the issues I've been dealing with, and it's an incredible heartbreak. And there's just a couple of points I want to make, which is that the Dateline show was fantastic, and one of the more horrible features of it is that it showed the lucky ones, believe it or not, because there were people who had some resources to win one of these legal battles, to even enter one of these legal battles to get services for a child, no less.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a way more resources than most people in this country have. And secondly, they were lucky because of the state they live in, as the Florida example made clear. So I feel like what we're talking about is we have to look at the values that our country has. We are just heartless, is what I have to say. And that you can see it in how we treat our most vulnerable citizens. And I feel like it runs the gamut, so that this does apply to people beyond those on the spectrum, and anyone with, for example, significant intellectual disabilities and other diagnoses. And I've seen, for example, wealthy towns where these folks are working in the supermarket and where the kids who are going to be the movers and shakers down the line are making fun of them, not to their faces, but who cares? The value system is there. And I just want to link it to some other work that's been in the news lately. I'm not going to remember the name of the book, but in fact, I think you did a show on it. The question of whether people in poverty, whether those are our children or their children. And this is the same question. And in fact, there's a great deal of overlap because even the examples of the callers in today who are doing such extraordinary things, in many ways, they're also some of the lucky and privileged ones.
Laura, our time is short. I have to cut in right there, I'm afraid. Kate Snow, how do you look at this? There's a lot of talk right now. We've heard from Chris Christie just this week about maybe some changes in Social Security, maybe some cutbacks. We've got big deficits in this country. And then you hear Laura say, we can be heartless. Are we close to doing the right thing? Do we need a revolution to do the right thing here, Kate?
When I interviewed the top-ranking person with the Department of Health and Human Services, she says, she's an Obama administration official, she says, we're not there yet. We're working on it. They have plans. They're trying to do better. But she hopes that all these families will collect their voices and become a collective voice to try to make some change.
Denise, as the numbers rise, do you see more attention? We've just got 15 seconds here.
Absolutely. And we can and we must do better. And what we need is clinically informed policy. And we need Dr. Shattuck and others like him to make sure that we get the data so our elected officials can make good decisions.
Denise Resnick, co-founder of the Southwest Autism Research and Resource Center. Denise, thank you so much for being with us from Phoenix today.
Thank you.
And Kate Snow, national correspondent for NBC News. She brought On the Brink to Dateline on Sunday. Kate, thank you for your reporting.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us and good luck. This is On Point.